Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Human History Podcast. I'm your host, James Baldwin, and on this podcast, we take a dive into the history of humans, mainly through our civilizations, focusing on a general understanding of the events, innovations, and figures which make up the history of us. I want to begin each episode by reminding everyone that I am neither a historian nor an archaeologist. This podcast is simply a way for me to share some information with you all about a subject which I find incredibly fascinating. The first season of the Human History Podcast will naturally start at the beginning with ancient history and the world's earliest civilizations. We're going to start with the earliest known civilizations in recorded history and then move our way around the map as we move through time. We're going to explore the Sumerians and other Mesopotamian empires, the Harappan in India, the progenitors of the Chinese in Central Asia. We'll eventually make our way to the Han Dynasty in China, the Romans, the Gupta Empire in India, which lasted until 543 AD. We'll also cross the oceans to discover the early peoples of Mesoamerica. So we got a lot going on. We'll also have a few non-civilization-centered episodes about things which I think are generally interesting and also just important for kind of attaining that general understanding of the history that we're shooting for here. Just an example, we're going to do an episode or maybe two on the Silk Road. So I'm looking forward to that one. Just a quick note, a lot of ancient history is known to us through the archaeological record. So different discoveries and texts. And a lot of these texts especially are, you know, they're mythological or they're religious in nature, or some of them are just clerical. So a lot of it can be interpreted in different ways. So we don't have a quote-unquote clear history of the ancient world, but we do have a general idea of what happened and who did what beginning around right around the middle of the third millennium BC. And that's the story I'm attempting to share with you here. So that being said, I am using some specific sources for this and other episodes, which does mean that for certain things, I'll be giving one historian or one archaeologist's point of view. But in cases where there seems to be a lot of debate or a lot of inconsistencies when it comes to the dating, I've done my best to point this out so that you guys know when something is maybe a little bit less hard fact, a little bit more speculation or hearsay. Okay, so here we go. On today's episode, we are talking about a civilization which some credit with inventing the wheel, building the first cities, developing the earliest system of writing, and building the first empires. Today we're talking about the Sumerians. The first thing I want to do before we start is acknowledge my sources. I'll put a full list of all the sources in the show notes. But the main sources that I used for this episode that you're going to probably hear me reference. First one is The History of the Ancient World, From the Earliest Accounts to the Fall of Rome by Susan Wise Bauer. This is going to be probably one of my main sources for a few of the episodes, obviously, as you can tell by the title. She does a great job. Her chapters are really concise, and they run through a nice chronological history, giving a good understanding of kind of just the background events and characters that kind of made up the story. So I'm going to be referencing her a lot. We also have The Sumerian World, which is edited by Harriet Crawford. And I also used the online Ancient History Encyclopedia. And then one more quick note. One of the main sources of information for all of these sources and all of information about ancient Sumerians and ancient Sumer is the King's List, which you're going to hear me reference during this episode. Just for some context, the King's List is an ancient Sumerian text preserved on clay tablets that records each of Sumer's kings. Goes from the earliest of kings who may or may not have been mythological to the end of the Sumerians in the beginning of the Isin dynasty around or in the late 3rd century BC. Okay. Many thousands of years ago, the Sumerian king Alulim ruled over Eridu, a walled city, a safe space carved out of the unpredictable and harsh river valley that the Romans would later name Mesopotamia. Alulim's rise to power marked the beginning of civilization, and his reign lasted for almost 30,000 years. I want to begin by just providing a brief introduction to the Sumerians. From there, I'll introduce you to some of the key figures who inhabited Sumer during this time period, and then we'll move on to discussion of the main events, some of the key innovations from the Sumerian era. So to start off with, where are we? The land known as Sumer occupied the southern plains of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, the northern terminus of the Persian Gulf in modern-day Iraq and Kuwait. If you look at a map, you can still see the area quite clearly. You can see the two rivers beginning at the Gulf and then sort of diverging slowly, creating almost a V. And it's in the southern part of this river valley between them. Where we find ancient Sumer. The Sumerians were one of the first civilizations of recorded human history. On top of devising agricultural techniques and building roads and canals as part of some of the world's first cities, Sumerians were responsible for an amazing number of firsts for our species. They gave us the first epic hero, the first monotheist, as Bauer says, the invention of the wheel and of writing, first written set of laws. It was really them, along with the settlements in the Indus Valley in India and in Asia, which we'll talk about in future episodes, that truly began the process of building civilizations. And it can provide us with a solid look at some of the earliest historical records of human beings as they made that shift from wandering hunter-gatherers into collections of small villages, into towns, and eventually into cities, engaging in essentially international trade. So the name Sumerian actually comes from Akkadian, which is the language of the north of Mesopotamia. And it's a later empire that we'll talk about, and we'll reference it during this episode as well. But in Akkadian, Sumerian means land of the civilized kings. They were once believed to be descendant of a group which came from the north to invade the southern plains of the Tigris and Euphrates. But more recent excavations using modern technology, and I believe it was sonar technology, tells kind of a different story. It kind of tells a story of a slow coming together of people, different peoples from the north, but as well as the south and the east, over many different generations. It was definitely one of the earliest agricultural civilizations to develop. And this intermingling theory that is more recent is further supported by the language. The Sumerian words are mostly built on one-syllable roots. But by the time they began to write their language, it was peppered with two-syllable roots, like the city of Eridu, for example. And these words are Semitic. And the Semitic people came, as we know from other history, they originated from the south and west of Sumer. Another thing is that the Semitic loanwords that we see in Sumerian are almost all names for farming techniques, like plow or furrow, or farmer, and other occupations which go along with farming, like basket maker and carpenter. And Bauer says this next part in fact, but I'm just going to use the term that's very possible That the Semites were the ones who introduced the Sumerians to these agricultural skills and these farming techniques. As far as when we're talking about, the most recent archaeological evidence suggests that peoples were inhabiting the land of Sumer long before around 4500 BC, possibly as far back as around 5400 BC. Some historians continue to prefer the name Sumerians as it applies to the peoples of the area from about 32 BC onwards. But that, I think, has a lot to do with just being a, maybe not call it a relic, but it has to do with the evidence that suggested the Sumerians were a distinct group who invaded from the north rather than the amalgamation of groups from the north, south, and east, which, quote unquote, seeped into the land known as Sumer in constant phases of settlement. And the end of Sumerian civilization can be placed right about 2004 BC, when the city of Ur fell to Elamite invaders, which we will talk about. In terms of the different time periods of the Sumerian era, you'll hear historians and archaeologists talk about these different time periods. The earliest, and again, with different archaeologists and different historians, there is some different verbiage used as far as the time periods are concerned. As far as I understand it, it's these names, the ones that I'm going to give to you, come from pottery that was discovered in these areas, and that's where the names come from. So the period, the really early period in Sumerian history, from prior to about 4200 BC, is referred to as the Ubaid period, which is U-B-A-I-D. And then once we get closer to around 4000 into like 3800 BC, we're getting into the early Uruk period, which is U-R-U-K, and we have an early and an early middle and a late Uruk period, and that lasts until right around 3000 BC. And after that we have what some call the Uruk, the third period, or the third Uruk period. Others have started calling it the Jamdat Nasr period. This is all mostly just for your guys' information. I know this is kind of a lot, but it's just kind of interesting. And then right around 2900 BC is when you start the early dynastic first and second periods. You move into the early dynastic third periods right around 2600. And then it's right around the 2300 time where we get the first dynasty of Ur. And that lasts for a couple hundred years until the Akkadian Empire takes over. And then we have the third dynasty of Ur, which comes back after the Akkadian Empire. And there's a few other dynasties that are in there that we'll talk about, but these are just kind of the main time periods that you're going to hear talked about. The third dynasty of Ur coming after the Akkadians, you'll see it, if you see it in writing, you'll see it as Ur, which is U-R, Ur the third, or they do in Roman numerals. So those are the kind of the main time periods as far as the Sumerians go that you'll see historians and archaeologists talk about. And it's actually kind of an interesting story as far as why this area kind of became what would become known as the cradle of civilization. So at the end of the last ice age, starting right around 11,000 BC, the temperatures started to rise. The land north of the Persian Gulf became dried out. And, you know, as this, these temperatures are rising, these glaciers from the ice age were receding. And then each year, the streams would flood, and then they would recede into their beds, and they would deposit silt onto the banks of the intertwining streams, and it would cause these streams to be pushed apart. So the Gulf of the Persian Gulf actually started to creep northwards. You know, about 11 or 10,000 BC, they think that the northern coast of the Persian Gulf was closer to modern-day Qatar, which is about 300 miles south of where it currently sits, which is pretty incredible. So the Gulf continued to creep northwards as the melting glaciers caused the sea levels to rise. And the people on the southern plain closest to the Gulf had to deal with this shifting landscape. And then you combine that with the seasonal floods, and there was also a lack of stone. There was no timber. There was no grasslands. But what the people in this area did have were the reeds, which grew along the banks of the streams, and they had mud, obviously. And the mud could be molded out and dried. You could mix it with reeds and you could bake it. And from that you get bricks, and those bricks would form the very first houses of the very first villages. They would eventually form the city walls, and they would eventually be used to form some of the earliest pots and dishes that humans would use in our history. And I'm going to post a link. There's this amazing video on YouTube of a gentleman who is just out in the woods, just going through this process, just showing you how you can essentially make reed mud bricks. It's pretty phenomenal. So I'll post that and you guys can check that out. And as far as kind of how these people were able to, you know, go from the, what we always hear about the hunter-gatherers who wandered through a lot of those areas for a long time, and even after the Sumerians continued to exist, and to this day we still have some tribes of hunter-gatherers. But it seems to be that the way that they were able to kind of settle, or maybe I should say the reason that they settled, was these advanced farming techniques that we saw come about, which, as we said, likely came from the Semitic tribes who moved into the area from the southwest. And then also the innovations in construction, like the mud brick, which allowed them to construct the homes and eventually the cities. The early peoples of the Sumerian plains built the communities really slowly. But by about 3600 BC, they'd built one of the world's earliest cities. They had invented the wheel and the sailboat and the first form of writing. So, you know, 3600 BC, we're looking at 5,000 years ago. A little bit more than, we're looking at more than 5,000 years ago, 5,500 years ago. We had the wheel, we had the sailboat, we had the first form of writing, the world's earliest cities. And it's all kind of coming from just this one little spot right on the northern coast of the Persian Gulf. It's pretty incredible to think about. So we're going to talk about some of the key figures in Sumerian history. In the Sumerian record, we have some of the most fascinating and eternal characters from our human history. We have Gilgamesh, which is a name I'm sure a lot of you will recognize, who's the first epic hero of literature. Gudea, the prince of Lagash. His statues are probably some of the most recognizable in the archaeological record. A lot of you have probably seen him in museums, and not known who he was, but his statues, a lot of his statues survive to this day. We also have Abram, who Bauer calls the first monotheist, and he would become Abraham, the father of three world religions. We have Ur-Nammu, King Ur-Nammu, who would lead the Sumerian Renaissance. He would set down the world's first known written set of laws. or it might have been his son Shulgi. We're not really 100% sure on that. But along with his son Shulgi, they both built a huge monument, which still towers over the Iraqi landscape to this day, which we will talk about later in the show. So, in the city of Uruk, around 2800 BC, a king named Mezkayagashir ruled. At the time, Uruk may have been the largest city in the world, with a population of between 40 and 80,000 people. Mezkayagashir expanded Uruk's trade to secure copper from Magan in modern-day Oman on the southern end of the Gulf, and tin from the mountain tribes of the Zagros Mountains to the east, ensuring Uruk's access to the metal it needed for weapons. And just a couple of quick notes here. The Sumerians started adding 10% tin or arsenic to their copper to produce bronze as early as around 3000 BC. And some put it a little bit earlier, some a little bit later. That in and of itself, it puts them in the Bronze Age a full 700 years prior to the Northern European civilizations, which is pretty incredible. And another note is that under Mezkayagashir, right around 2800 BC, and possibly earlier, the Sumerians were using reed boats that they caulked with bitumen, which was capable of carrying up to 20 tons of metal, which they could use to trade grain, oil, and wool for copper at the ports of Magan, which just blows my mind. The fact that 5,000 years ago, people were building boats out of reeds growing on the sides of rivers that could carry 20 tons of metal hundreds of miles through the sea is pretty incredible. And in case you guys aren't familiar, bitumen is essentially tar. It's the viscous form of petroleum, which is a natural byproduct of the decomposition of plants. It's essentially the early version of what we use to pave our roads today. But some interesting facts is it's actually been used by humans for at least 40,000 years. So one of the earlier discoveries of humans. It's pretty useful. So this is from thoughtco.com. In some places, bitumen extrudes naturally from terrestrial sources. In others, it appears in liquid pools, which can harden into mounds. And in still others, it oozes from underwater seeps, washing up as tar balls along sandy beaches and rocky shorelines. So I just have this image of this ancient Sumerian, or probably a group of them, just going out to this tar pit that they know of and just collecting just masses of the stuff and using it in large scale, at least maybe not large scale as in size, but as in, mass production of boats. It's pretty incredible. So Mezkayagashir went down to Oman to get copper, went over to the east to get tin so that they could secure weapons. And when he died, his son Enmerkar took over, and in an apparent bid to live up to his father's reputation, he actually launched an attack against the Elamite city of Arata, which was a trade partner of Uruk, a relatively booming city, quote, and this is a quote, admired for its riches, its metal workers, and its skilled stone cutters. And actually this story about Enmerkar and his attack on Arata is one of the earliest stories that we have available to us in the written human record. But the attack did presumably fail, and Enmerkar died without having children. And he was succeeded by a man named Lugalbanda, who was a fellow warrior of Enmerkar's. And he was actually the star of a few epic tales in his own right. Those stories that I, the story that I was talking about where they wrote about the this attack from Enver Kar on Arata, and Lugubanda came out as one of the stars of that show, I guess I would put it. But apparently the attack did not go well. But according to Wikipedia, the Sumerian Kings list tells us that Lugubanda was the second king of Uruk, and he ruled for 1,200 years. The Epic Tales are based on his time as a warrior in the army of Enver Kar fighting to take Arata, as we said, yeah. And so he ruled for a while. And then after him, there was an unrelated warrior. And it doesn't seem to be any hereditary succession after that. And then it seems to be about 100 years later when we come across a new king and a new bid for power from Uruk. And this king's name was Gilgamesh. From Ancient History Encyclopedia, this is a quote. Known as Bilgamesh in Sumerian, Gilgamos in Greek, and associated closely with the figure of Dumuzi from the Sumerian poem The Descent of Inanna, Gilgamesh is widely accepted as the historical fifth king of Uruk, who reigned in the 26th century BCE. End quote. So Gilgamesh, he was a real person. He really did exist. He was likely an usurper to the throne, which was not uncommon for that time and that place. His father was likely a high priest in the service of the god An. And this is from Bauer. Quote, the king list calls him Lilu, a word which implied demonic powers. So that's fun. Gilgamesh claimed Lugubanda as his father, which maybe is a good call if people think that your father has demonic powers. Lugubanda, I mean, like we said, it had been about 100 years. But again, this is something that you'll see again and again in a lot of these ancient civilizations, is when a new king comes to power, you know, he'll claim descent from whoever he believes is going to give him the strongest claim to the throne. And it really doesn't matter if that person you're claiming as your father lived 100 years earlier. But he did, you know, he did succeed. He took the throne of Uruk, and then he turned his eye to Kish, which is another early Sumerian city. And by that time, it was the pearl of the Sumerian world. And it was the home to the man claiming superiority over the sacred city of Nippur and of the Sumerian region. So at that time, it was essentially the person running Kish essentially claimed themselves to be, they called themselves the king of Kish, which essentially meant that they were calling themselves the king of Sumer. So it was really the central place, kind of the main goal for anybody who really wanted to consolidate power and rule. So Gilgamesh turned his eye there. But after a campaign north, so he took a campaign north into the woods so that he could secure some timber to build fortified walls, which in the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is the earliest of epic tales, it talks about stone and copper walls, but that was an exaggeration. They would have been wood. Timber walls, which Gilgamesh would have had to take soldiers north into the land of, I'm trying to remember, I think it would have been the Elamites where they were going to get this wood. But he goes and gets it, and he builds these fortified walls, so now he's ready for Kish. So he marched on a city ruled by a man named Enmebaragesi. And he's the first Sumerian king whose reign can actually be estimated as being on the throne around 2700 BC. Enmebaragesi ruled for years before Gilgamesh ever came to power in Uruk. He was not the only king of Kish, or he was not only the king of Kish, but like I said, he was the protector of the sacred city of Nippur. And so Gilgamesh gathered his armies, got his siege weapons, got his horses, and he marched on Kish, and he failed. We know this because Enmeberegesi actually died on the throne, and he passed his rule down to his son Aga, who actually reached out to Gilgamesh for peace when he came to power. But Gilgamesh actually attacked Kish again. He attacked Aga. And this was actually against the wishes of the Council of Elders, but with the support of the Council of the Younger Able-Bodied Men, which Bauer tells us is a common form of government in Sumer. You'd have these two groups, similar to a parliament, I guess you could sort of relate it that way, or to the Senate in Greece, in ancient Greece. They were essentially just these councils that the leader would go to and kind of seek advice and sometimes permission, depending on the power situation. But yeah, it was generally, there was, you know, older, wiser men, and then there would be the younger, more able-bodied men. And this would be a common form of government that you would see. So Gilgamesh was offered peace, and he apparently saw it as a sign of weakness rather than as a sign of peace. And he attacked, and he failed again. And we know this because actually the first dynasty of Kish, which is the dynasty that Enmeberegesi and Aga were a part of, it was actually eventually brought down by the king of Ur, whose name was Mesenapata. He had been quietly waiting in the wings for decades as Gilgamesh kind of ran himself up against Kish. And after he retreated for the second time, the king of Ur moved in and he took down Aga and claimed the throne and the title of Kish. So he took the title of Kish, but he also ruled Ur and Nippur. And so this time Gilgamesh was a little bit more patient. He waited until the old king, Mesenapata, died, and he passed the throne to his son, Meskayaguna. And then he finally made a third attempt and a successful attempt to take Kish. So at this point, he'd taken control of Kish, Uruk, which was his city, and Nippur. And this is more land than any Sumerian king before him. But he did die shortly after consolidating all his power. And he left everything to his son. So now I want to talk a little bit about the Epic of Gilgamesh, which is the story that I'm sure a lot of you have heard of. It is known as the oldest piece of epic literature in world history. It's a composite of 6 different stories and a postscript, which has been translated from bits and pieces of clay tablets, written in a number of languages, including Sumerian and Assyrian, which come later on, later empire of the region. And the stories that we find are dated from anywhere between 2100 BC and 626 BC. It was first discovered in its Akkadian version in the mid-19th century by Hormuzd Razam and Austin Henry Layard and W.K. Loftus on clay tablets unearthed from the ruins of the library of Ashurbanipal, who was the last great Assyrian king who ruled until about 627 BC. So the 6 stories that you find in the Epic of Gilgamesh are the tale of Enkaidu, which tells a story of the people seeking deliverance from the tyrant Gilgamesh. So the gods send the creature Enkidu down, but Gilgamesh actually tames him and they become friends, but that still creates peace in the process. And if you read different interpretations, it's essentially, it talks about Enkidu being Gilgamesh's own struggles for essentially being a responsible leader and maturing. It's very interesting. I mean, we could probably do an entire episode just on the story of the Epic of Gilgamesh, but we won't do that yet. So the second story is The Journey to the Cedar Forest, which actually tells the story of the campaign into the North Woods to go and get that timber that they needed to fortify the walls before they marched on Kish. And in this story, Gilgamesh defeats the giant Hugeness, or in, I believe it's Sumerian, his name is Humbaba. The third story is The Bowl of Heaven. Gilgamesh spurns the advances of the goddess Inanna, so she sends the Bowl of Heaven after him and Enkidu, but they do kill it. But as punishment, Inanna, who is actually also known as Ishtar, you may have heard, she sentences Enkidu to death and kills him, unfortunately. The fourth story is Gilgamesh's journey. And Gilgamesh is so torn after the death of his friend, he goes on a search for immortality. And he reaches the land of Utnapishtim, who is the Sumerian Noah figure. And I think, I haven't decided, but I do think that I am going to do an episode solely devoted to ancient flood myths, because I think that's an interesting subject. And we would talk more about Utnapishtim and the Sumerian flood myth there. But fourth story, Gilgamesh goes and he actually finds him. Fifth story is the story of the flood, in which Utnapishtim tells him the story. And that's where the story, actually the ancient Sumerian flood story, comes from the Epic of Gilgamesh. Or at least that's where it has been recorded and where we found it, I should say. The sixth story is Gilgamesh's quest, in which he searches and fails to find immortality. There's obviously, you know, there's a lot more to all of these stories. I'm just giving a very brief description to just kind of give you an idea of the stories behind the Epic of Gilgamesh. Then there is a postscript which laments his death. And only the first two stories and the postscript can actually be said with relative confidence to be from within striking distance of his lifetime, you know, talking closer to that 2100 BC range. And Bauer comments on the relationship between death and the oldest epic story known to mankind, which is kind of interesting. Gilgamesh, you know, as we know, he attained godlike status within only about 100 years of his actual lifetime. But a part of his story is his death and his eventual inability to attain immortality. And actually, the lament from the postscript to the Epic of Gilgamesh goes like this. You were given the kingship. Everlasting life was not your destiny. You had power to bind and loose, supremacy over the people, victory in battle. But do not abuse this power. Deal justly with your servants in the palace. So that's Gilgamesh, one of the earliest characters of human literature known to us, and who is the star of the oldest piece of epic literature. And it, and, you know, I do find it interesting. And this is one of the reasons that I do love history, is finding things like this where, you know, I had always known about the Epic of Gilgamesh. I've heard of it. I knew what it was. I didn't know you know, I never read it. I didn't know the details, but I did know that it was the story of an epic hero, and his name was Gilgamesh. Just essentially all I knew. So it's interesting to kind of go back and see that, you know, we do know that he was a real person. We do know that he, you know, and then the interesting facts about his life, you know, that he was likely an usurper to the throne, which, again, carries a lot more negative connotation in modern context. And in those days was really not that. It was quite normal. So don't think that I'm maligning Gilgamesh at all. Gilgamesh fans out there. But, you know, just the idea of his struggles to take Kish, his failures, and his eventual success, which was short-lived. But then for him to come back, you know, so short after to be immortalized that way, to a point where 5,000 years later we still know his name is and still talking about him is it's pretty incredible. So we are going to go on to another figure in Sumerian history, Gudea or Gudea of Lagash, the prince of Lagash, Enlil of Lagash. These are all different names for him. And I want to take a second here to just say at this point in time, because I'm kind of doing a little chronological order with these figures. So I want to just talk about for a quick minute, the Akkadian Empire, which we'll cover more fully in another episode, formed under Sargon in around 2334 BC. So he created the Akkadian Empire, essentially, which ruled for about 200 years. And then the fall of a god, which was the Akkadian capital, happened around 2150. There was an invasion, a Gutian invasion, which we'll talk a little bit about. The point I'm trying to get to here is that in the middle of the Sumerian era, Sargon came in and established the Akkadian Empire, which ruled for about 200 or so years, after which we see the Sumerian Renaissance, which began with Gudea. The whole point is you'll see some historians and some archaeologists, they'll refer to the time after the Akkadian Empire as a Neo-Sumerian era. But for the purposes of this podcast, I am just going to call them all Sumerians up until the fall of Ur in 2004 BC. But I just kind of wanted to give you guys that little side note, just in case if you ever come across the term Neo-Sumerian, you'll know what they're talking about. So Gudea of Lagash, he's pretty well known. For, as I talked about a little bit earlier, he's known for the numerous distinctive statues of him, which have survived to this day. As far as who he was as a person, he likely came from outside the city of Lagash, Lagash being another one of the main Sumerian cities, during this time. He married the daughter of Lagash's ruler, Ur-Baba. Her name was Nanala, which secured him his entry into the royal house. Now, I kind of mentioned it briefly, but there was an invasion from the north from people called the Gutians, who were roaming tribal people who came in and just really wrecked some stuff. Kind of took over. The Akkadians couldn't fight them. And, you know, the Sumerians were essentially under Akkadian rule, subjugated at this point, not very powerful. So the Gutians came in and essentially took down the Akkadians and set up, I don't want to say set up shop, because, you know, they were much of a much different culture, than the people of the Sumerian plain. They didn't necessarily set up cities and societies and things in that manner. So we do see the fall of the Akkadians. And then a little bit after the fall of the Akkadians, which was around 2150 BC, with the fall of their capital, that's when we see Gudea start to begin the process of an uprising, essentially. And he was responsible for kicking all the Gutians out of Lagash, and eventually took over as its king. He's not listed on the Sumerian king list, and Bauer suggests that his power never reached beyond the walls of Lagash. But from other sources that I saw, what it seems to me is that Gudea was never really interested in being a king, so he kept the title of Enlil, which is essentially, if I understand it correctly, is more a governor of the city state. So less of a king, and I think that may have more to do with the fact that he's not listed as a Sumerian king, is because he never pretended to be a king or called himself a king. But he reigned for about 20 years in Lagash, from 2140 to 2120 BC. And he instituted some social reforms. He canceled debts. He allowed women to own family land. Just a couple of the examples. This is from SumerianShakespeare.com, kind of going back to what we were just talking about. It says, although Gudea used the title Ensi, which was ruler or governor, rather than the more exalted title of Lugal, which was king, he was a king in all but name. So that's interesting. So, I mean, the people followed him. The people, he had the power to make changes and obviously, you know, institute these social reforms. So he essentially was a king. He just doesn't seem to have called himself a king, which, whether or not that has to do with his own personal principles or whether he was just clever and maybe didn't want to call himself a king, there's not really any way to know that. But we do know, because there were victory tablets, clay tablets, and they do claim that Gudea reestablished trade with the Elamites for copper, with India for red stones, and with northern parts of Mesopotamia. And we do know that he brought stone from Magan to build statues, because we still have a lot of these statues. And a lot of these statues show him in plain ceremonial clothing with hands clasped humbly in front of him. They're very recognizable. You'll see him. He looks very, as I said, very humble. And, you know, again, historians and archaeologists talk about what this means and whether or not this kind of shows a true deference to the gods and a true piousness and humbleness for his position, or whether he just knew that it would be smarter to play it that way. Either way, it's pretty interesting. And again, like, we still have these statues to this day, which I find fascinating. And we do know he did build a temple to the god of war and the patron deity of Lagash, which is Ningirsu. We have his recounting of this experience preserved on clay tablets. It's actually known as the building of Ningirsu's temple. And so Gudea was a really interesting figure. He was kind of the one, you could say, he was the initial figure of the Sumerian Renaissance. We'll get to Ur-Nammu later, who kind of did a little bit more, expanded a little bit. But as far as in the immediate aftermath of the Akkadian Empire falling, Gudea was pretty quick to reestablish control of his own city-state and institute some pretty important social reforms that, you know, come down to us even to this day, and then his statues. And No, I mean, and that's the thing. When we see these stones coming from Oman, hundreds and hundreds of miles away, it kind of gives you, that's kind of one of those things where archaeologists and historians can say, okay, they had some level of, you know, prosperity to be able to do those types of things. Not only to be able to build the boats, and, you know, to be able to have a place where you have the experts to be able to do those things and to be able to get the materials to build them, but then to be able to safely travel hundreds of miles in the ancient world, you know, you have to have established some level of power, and you can see that. Okay, so now I want to talk about someone who you could probably put on a list of most influential people in human history. And I don't mean influential as in necessarily as in, you know, their direct actions created direct influence in their time. More that Abram was a person who lived, and within, you know, within about 1,000 years of him living, I would say within, yeah, within 1 or 2,000 years of him living, you have 3 world religions essentially based off of his life. And those 3 world religions dominate the world that we live in today. And it's all, I mean, it can all really be, I mean, honestly, I guess you could make the argument that he would be the most important or influential figure as far as being able to draw a direct line from obviously Judaism and Islam directly to Abraham. And then there's a direct line from Christianity to Judaism. And I mean, so, and I mean, to be honest with you, I wasn't even aware of the fact that Abraham was a real figure. I honestly thought that he was a historical biblical figure. I wasn't a very good Catholic growing up, apparently, and I didn't read my Bible. I didn't do my research. But I honestly thought that he was a historical figure. But he was very real, and he was Sumerian, which is very interesting. And yeah, so we're going to talk about him. So, the freedom of Lagash under Gudea was followed closely by freedom of Uruk, which, you remember, was the home of Gilgamesh, under its king, Atuhagol. And again, some of these pronunciations are going to be my interpretation, and you may hear them differently. And honestly, there are slightly different variations in spelling, depending on which source you're pulling from. But in general, I think, you know, if you were to see some of these things in writing, you would know what I was talking about. So Atuhagol freed Uruk from the Gushans. But then he expanded his power beyond Uruk. So following the expulsions, quote, his soldiers marched in their wake out like a spreading ripple of circles to Eridu, south of Ur, probably as far north as the ancient sacred city of Nippur, end quote. It was during this march when he was going to Ur, which he would later lose to Ur-Nammu, who we'll talk about in a little bit, that a citizen of Ur named Terah decided to move his household, including its livestock, servants, wives, sons, his sons and their families. And they were going to move westward towards a land called Canaan, which was not known as Canaan then. It's a little bit anachronistic. but among his household was his son Abram and his wife Sarai, or Sarai, S-A-R-A-I. Terah was likely either Akkadian or a related tribe. Genesis from the Bible traces his ancestry back to Shem, who Bauer points out is the biblical progenitor of the Semites. According to Genesis, Abram received a message from God telling him both that he would be made into a great nation and that he must leave his country and people, and go, quote, to the land I will show you, end quote. Bauer notes that the chronology here is kind of ambiguous. It's not really clear whether Abram received the message in Ur and then convinced Terah to head west, after which they were sidetracked to a different place, which we'll talk about, or whether Terah headed west for other reasons and then was sidetracked to Haran, and then Abram received the message to head back west when they were already in Haran. So the chronology is, like I said, like most things in ancient history, it's a little ambiguous. This was interesting because people living in Ur in the second millennium BC were most likely worshippers of the moon god Sin and his daughter Inanna, who were the patron deities of the city. And the family names themselves show a connection to the Akkadian and Sumerian pantheon, which that in and of itself is a whole thing. Here, this is from Bauer, quote, "By blood, Abram was no different from the Semites around him, and not so different from the people who inhabited the land he was headed towards. But by divine fiat, he was separated from the rest and began something new. One Semite out of the rest, one God rising above the chaos of polytheism. He was the first monotheist." So yes, this idea of, you know, regardless of the chronology of it, this idea of receiving a message from the God was not something we've seen in human history up to this point, which is, you know, it's really interesting. So either way, Terah and his family headed northwest along the Euphrates. They eventually sidetracked a bit and settled in the town of Haran, which was a moon-worshipping town on a well-traveled trade hub. After a number of years, it was a while, long enough for Ur-Nammu to have taken Utuhagal's throne, and then he ruled for 18 years, and then he passed it on to his son Shulgi, who ruled for another 4 to 5 years, and it was about that time when Abram took Sarai and headed back out west towards Canaan. And like I said, Canaan is anachronistic. There really wasn't a name for the land that we now call Israel or Palestine at the time of Abram. It's been inhabited by Western Semites, related to those who settled. So it was inhabited by Western Semites who were related to the Semites who settled with the original Sumerians. But they just continued on along the coast of the Mediterranean. And so it had been inhabited for centuries. They built a network of cities and trade routes, nothing really of note, and there's not really records left behind. And Abram is really the first historical character of note to come out to us from this area. There was a combination of ecological factors and the collapse of the Old Kingdom in Egypt. And Egypt was the main trading partner for the Western Semites of that region. So it caused Abram, the ecological factors and the collapse of the Old Kingdom caused Abram to move south out of the land of Canaan into Egypt. He arrived there right around 2085 BC. And the reception of Egyptians to Western Semites was not exactly warm. This is a quote from Aktoi III, whose reign would have not been far off from Abram's arrival in Egypt. So this is a quote from the ruler of Egypt. "The vile Asiatic. It goes ill with the place where he is, lacking in water and covered in brushwood. He never dwells in one place, but has been forced to stray through want, traversing the lands on foot. The Asiatic is a crocodile on the riverbank. He snatches on the lonely road." End quote. So it tells you a little bit about how the Egyptians felt about the Western Semites. So actually, while he was in Egypt, Abram had to pretend that Sarai was his sister to keep from being killed by any pharaoh who may want to marry her. And this fear actually came true, apparently, and she was brought into the house of the current pharaoh. But Abram just said it was his sister. So he was given all sorts of gifts from the pharaoh. "Thank you so much for bringing your sister to me. She's beautiful." Except after that, the pharaoh's palace was cursed. And then he returned Sarai to Abram. And they went back to Canaan, settling near a town called Hebron. excuse me. So it had been a while since they'd received the message about fathering a new nation. And Sarai was getting closer to being past childbearing age. So in a practice not uncommon in Sumer at the time, Abram conceived a son with Sarai's servant Hagar. So apparently God was not pleased with this, and he reminded Abram of the promise, and he reiterated that he meant that the new nation would be of him and Sarai specifically. And it's at this point that God renames Abraham and Sarah to seal the bond between them. And there's different interpretations of the meaning of Abraham. The father is exalted is one interpretation, or father of many is another. From ancienthebrew.org, while many suggest that Abram means exalted father and Abraham means father of a multitude, both names in fact mean exactly the same thing: father lifted up or exalted father. So soon after God reiterates his promise and renames Abraham and Sarah, they run into another king who takes Sarah as his wife. Seems to be some bad luck on Abraham's part, or Sarah is just incredibly beautiful. So this king's name was Abimelech, and he ruled the city of Gerger in the region between Egypt and Canaan. The city of Gerar, G-E-R-A-R. But he too was cursed. So every woman in his palace became barren, and he was apparently unable to perform until he finally gave Sarah back to Abraham. He gave Abraham a bunch of gifts and told him he could settle in any of his lands. So then years later... And so there's an interesting story. Years later, in a dispute over a well, Abraham offered a pact with Abimelech and gave him livestock as proof he had dug the well. So there was a problem. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, the backstory is something like some people intruded on Abram's well, and then Abimelech came out and basically said, you know, was backing these people up. But then Abraham was like, didn't want to cause trouble. So he offered him a pact, gave him some livestock, but he also, he gave him some livestock as proof that he was the one who dug the well. And then to commemorate the pact, he planted a grove at the site of the well, which they call Beersheba, which is a town that you can still visit to this day. And you can still visit the well, actually. So God's promise was eventually fulfilled, and Abraham and Sarah gave birth to Isaac when both were in old age. Has Abraham at 100 and Sarah was around 91 when they gave birth to Isaac. So this would mark the beginning of a new race. And Abraham's instructed to circumcise the baby and himself and all the males of his family. Bauer says, quote, "Presumably the sign would remind them at the crucial moment that they were not to mingle their blood with other races," end quote. So that's quite interesting origin story. And then, you know, you see this when it comes to find time, when it comes time to find Isaac a wife, Abraham sends a servant back to Northwest Mesopotamia and brings back his great niece, Rebecca. She's from the relations who'd stayed behind in Haran. And that was essentially, you know, that's essentially what we call the beginning of the Jewish people. Or all Abrahamic people. Well, no, that would be, I'm sorry. So when Hagar became pregnant, Sarai actually, with Abram's permission, sent her away. But the story goes that she was approached by an angel on the road who told her that her son would also be the father of a nation of people. So she returned to Abram and raised her son Ishmael in his household. And according to the Quran, when Ishmael was grown, he and Abraham, in the Quran is Ibrahim, traveled to Mecca and built the Kaaba, which is the first house for the worship of Allah. This is the place to which all people of the book are told to turn and pray. People of the book, meaning followers of the Quran, followers of Islam, quote, "Wherever you are, turn your faces in that direction." So Abraham essentially is the direct father of Judaism and Islam, and obviously the stories about his sons and about the timeline of it all, giving birth at 191, I mean, these are all stories that were relayed later on. But we do know that Abraham was a real Sumerian who lived sometime in the 3rd millennium BC, who moved from Ur and moved up to the eastern coast of the Mediterranean and down into Egypt and back. And I mean, we do know that he was a real person who existed. And these stories about his sons come to us from the Bible. And it is fascinating to me how these stories have basically shaped the world that we live in. And just so, you know, I guess I do have to mention, I guess, the most well-known in the Western world, one of the most well-known of all the Bible stories. So I'm just going to, honestly, I'm just going to quote Wikipedia here. At some point in Isaac's youth, Abraham was commanded by God to offer his son up as a sacrifice in the land of Moriah. The patriarch traveled 3 days until he came to the mount that God told him of. He then commanded the servants to remain while he and Isaac proceeded alone into the mount. Isaac carried the wood upon which he would be sacrificed. Along the way, Isaac asked his father where the animal for the burnt offering was, to which Abraham replied, "God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering." Just as Abraham was about to sacrifice his son, he was interrupted by the angel of the Lord, and he saw behind him a ram caught in a thicket by his horns, which he sacrificed instead of his son. For his obedience, he received another promise of numerous descendants and abundant prosperity. After this event, Abraham went to Beersheba. End quote. So After Sarah's death, she lived, obviously, to be quite old, as the story is told. Abraham did marry again, a concubine named Keturah, and he had six more sons with her. Their names were Zimran, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua. I'm sorry. Sorry, some of these names are a little bit difficult for me. And they're a little bit obscured from where I typed them. They were being my word processor obviously did not like them very much. So he fathered six more sons, Zimran, Jokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shua. And Abraham is actually believed by some to be the father of many peoples, including Israelites, Ishmaelites, the Edomites, the Amalekites, the Kenizzites, the Midian. Some people think he actually fathered the Assyrians as well. And the Midianites. And it's said that he died at 175 years old. Again, similar to Gilgamesh, where there's obviously a large mix of mythological and historical information intermingled as far as our understanding of the person. It is really interesting. It was interesting in particular to understand his history in the context of something so secular as just talking about ancient civilizations, and talking about the cities of Uruk and Ur. It's a very it just shows you the power of story, honestly. I guess Gilgamesh and Abram are both very, very good examples of the power of story. So we're going to go on now. We're going to talk about Ur-Nammu. Now, Ur-Nammu was a king who was a part of the, what some call the Neo-Sumerian Empire. After driving the Gutians out of Ur, to give a little background on Ur-Nammu, because we've mentioned him a little bit, but just to give you a little reminder, Etuhagal, who after driving the Gutians out of Ur, he actually gave the city of Ur over to his son-in-law, who was Ur-Nammu. And some accounts speak vaguely about Etuhagal's sudden death and Ur-Nammu's quickness to take advantage of the power vacuum. They kind of talk about it as a natural. I think they say he drowned, or he just suddenly died, and Ur-Nammu was there. And but Bauer actually gives a little bit of a different take, and she says, quote, after driving the Gutians out of Ur, Etuhagal left Ur-Nammu in charge of the city, with troops on hand. Shortly afterwards, Ur-Nammu sent his soldiers against his own king. End quote. So, could be possible that Etuhagal met with a sudden natural death, and Ur-Nammu was, as his right-hand man, the natural one to claim power. Also seems quite possible that Ur-Nammu seized power in an incredibly hostile and fragile post-Akkadian Sumerian revival, which, as much as I am understanding about the way that things went at that point, is probably something that I'm more inclined to believe. But again, it's not something that we know for a fact in such as ancient history. Regardless of how his rule began, once he was in power, Ur-Nammu seems to have been pretty universally regarded as truly competent and thoughtful. He's known for expanding the Sumerian Empire through some military force, but mainly through alliance and negotiations. he built a lot of temples, like Gudea, to restore the glory of the Sumerian gods. He was a builder and rebuilder. He built roads, walls, built canals to bring fresh water into the cities. And he along with his son, built the Great Ziggurat of Ur, which is just a phenomenal piece of ancient architecture that you can still see today. It still stands in Iraq. And it's just huge. And I'll talk a little bit about the Great Ziggurat of Ur. I'll just tell you. So, I mean, the ziggurats were essentially the first large-scale temples. It's not entirely, you know, there's not a huge agreement on how exactly they used them. It's most likely that they were essentially just temples to the gods, not so much burials like the Egyptian pyramids. So this is from khanacademy.org, quote, what Wooley, and Wooley was the person who I believe discovered this, or was the first Western person to go and see it and categorize it, I guess is what I should say. What Wooley found was a massive rectangular pyramidal structure oriented to true north, 210 by 150 feet, constructed with three levels of terraces, standing originally between 70 and 100 feet and 100 feet high. Three monumental staircases led up to a gate at the first terrace level. Next, a single staircase rose to a second terrace, which supported a platform on which a temple and the final and highest terrace stood. So it was quite a large structure. And actually, in our next episode, I'm going to talk about ziggurats a little bit more. But I just wanted to, I think it's really cool. So I wanted to kind of just give you that little bit about that one right now. Ur-Nammu, he encouraged arts and culture. He revitalized the economy of Ur, and the other city-states that were under his control. So historians and archaeologists like to talk about this time as the Sumerian Renaissance. And they say that this was the beginning of the third dynasty of Ur, in terms of the time periods of Sumerians. And another thing that we'll talk about in terms of Ur-Nammu is that he is actually the one, or his son, again, one of those ancient history things, we're not entirely certain. But he is the one who established the code of Ur-Nammu, which was, as far as human history goes, our earliest record of written laws. And like I said, it's not 100% certain whether it was established by Ur-Nammu or his son, Shulgi, who was his successor. But regardless, the text of these clay tablets represents the earliest known written set of laws in human history, possibly written down sometime around 2150 BC. And it's clear that in order for this set of codes to have been accepted and widely used, the people must have had a universal respect for the gods and their messengers, which were the kings. So while standing armies are helpful in the enforcement of laws, their success really depends more deeply on the acceptance by the people of the authority of the laws themselves, i.e. that they came directly from God. And so this is just an excerpt from a book called Babylon, Mesopotamia, and the Birth of Civilization. It's published by Thomas Dunn Books in 2010. Quote, although it is neither a true law code, being far from comprehensive, nor, some say, even introduced by Ur-Nammu, but by his son Shulgi, code or no, although we only have fragments, They are enough to show that the laws covered both civil and criminal matters. Among criminal provisions, it specifies which should be capital offenses, murder, robbery, deflowering another man's virgin wife, and adultery when committed by a woman. For other misdemeanors, the penalty was a fine in silver. Urnammu's code stands in contrast to the more famous laws of Hammurabi, drafted some three centuries later, with its savage provision of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, end quote. So, just some examples, and we're going to talk about Hammurabi and the Babylonians and his code in another episode. But just some examples of the laws from the code of Urnammu. These I just find really interesting. So this was probably sometime around 2100, 2150 BC in ancient Sumeria. Some of the earliest cities, some of the earliest empires, collections of cities. And these laws were to be understood by tens of thousands, if not more, if not hundreds of thousands of citizens. For the first time, these laws were essentially understood throughout an empire. If a man committed a kidnapping, he is to be imprisoned and pay 15 shekels of silver. If a man proceeded by force and deflowered the virgin slave woman of another man, that man must pay 5 shekels of silver. If a man appeared as a witness and was shown to be a perjurer, he must pay 15 shekels of silver. If a man knocked out the eye of another man, he shall weigh out half a mina of silver. If a man knocked out a tooth of another man, he shall pay 2 shekels of silver. If a man, in the course of a scuffle, smashed the limb of another man with a club, he shall pay 1 mina of silver. So, you know, it's pretty interesting. It is, as as the author said, I think the author of Babylon, Mesopotamia and the Birth of Civilization, Kriwizek, as he said, like, it stands in pretty stark contrast to Hammurabi's code, which we see referenced in the Bible. And I mean, still referenced in law codes to this day, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. But we see these codes, this code of laws from Urnammu from 300 years earlier is very measured. It's very, and you know, obviously we can have the discussion. I mean, I don't think it would be worth having the discussion about whether or not these laws are fairly written, because it's a completely different time, a completely different culture. We would have really no way to accurately have that discussion. But I think what can be said is that they are very, they're written in a way that it's very thoughtful. They're not harsh. They're not, I guess brutal is the right word. I think that they convey a level of society that exists that is far beyond what a lot of people would probably think existed, you know, 4,000 years ago. Okay, so that's our first episode on the Sumerians. We are going to come back and do episode 2 and talk about the key events and the innovations in the Sumerian civilization, from the Sumerian civilization. It's so interesting. I mean, because it's some of the earliest things. I mean, some of the earliest cities. We have the wheel, the earliest forms of writing. We'll go into kind of the idea behind how writing developed. Very quickly, obviously, it's not going to be anything in depth. We're going to talk more about the ziggurats, because I think those are very cool. And we're going to talk about the rise of the Akkadian Empire, the rise and fall of the Akkadian Empire. We're not going to go too in depth into the empire itself, just because we're going to save that for another episode. And then, you know, we'll talk a little bit more about that, the Sumerian Renaissance under Urnammu. And we'll talk about Shulgi. a little bit. And we will talk about the fall of the Sumerians under Ibbi-Sin, the fall of Ur. So it's a lot of pretty exciting stuff to talk about next time. I want to thank you guys for listening, and I guess I won't see you next time. I guess it's a terrible way to end a podcast to say I'll see you next time. I guess the better thing to say is be excellent to each other.